You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Hello and welcome to Matt Meets the Music Industry. I am here with my dear friend, Chris Merrick of Merrick Media PR. How are you today, Chris?
I'm very well, my dear friend, Matt. Evening over here, morning for you.
But, Oh, yes, of course.
I just love that we can share this time together today, this evening.
So okay,
I was just explaining to Matt off the call before we started, it's been windy at my place for like a week and I'm going a bit loopy.
So can you just to start off, you know, Merrick Media is one of the premier Australian rock and metal PRs. Is that an accurate summation? And now you've started doing consulting.
Yeah, well, I mean, the very, very long story short, I worked at every major label. I worked at a company where we had pretty much all of the metal labels under one distribution banner for Australia. And then that ended. And then I basically consulted for like half of those labels under Merrick Media. And that's been going for 8 years. So I do a lot of metal labels PR into Australia, such as Metal Blade, Napalm, Ear Music, Peaceville, list goes on. And also independent bands from Australia and now around the world to the global press. So like, you know, where I'm taking international bands to the Australian media, I'm sharing the love back by taking independent Aussie bands to the global media. And that's always been, you know, one of my things, because there was kind of no one doing that. Not on a sort of heavy level. You know, there's the odd one or two bands that manages to get over there and make a name for themselves. The others didn't really have the ability, the opportunity. So yeah, and since pretty much the start of the whole COVID situation, consulting has been a big part of what I've been doing. But that was a pure coincidence that the timing of that happened as it did, because I was kind of looking towards doing them anyway. My wife,
you and I had been talking about it for like a year.
It was a long time coming. I think that was the catalyst to just start it, because, you know, my wife would come in and I'd be on the phone with an artist or somebody. Who are you talking to? I was like, oh, a band. And she goes, client? And I'm like, no, just helping someone out. And she goes, so 2 hours of your time giving this band advice, I'm not begrudging that, but now you're going to be late 2 hours for the rest of the day, which is going to push back dinner and all of this kind of stuff. Why don't you do what you do as a service? And that kind of was the inspiration for it. And yeah, by the time I got all the pieces together, COVID happened. I lost a lot of touring because I was also doing tons of tour PR. Like I did, Australia had a very famous festival called Soundwave. I did like 9 of those, a couple of Australian downloads and everything in between, and independent tours and all this other stuff. So there was kind of like all of that stopped when COVID hit. So the consults very neatly just filled the gap, and they've been going ever since. And I'm really, really happy with them.
Absolutely. Which, you know, how, you know, obviously Australia is kind of a unique market and I really enjoy it as a market, but what do you feel people don't understand about the Australian market when they're coming and trying to promote their music there?
That it's not one market, it's 5 capital cities and a lot of nothing in between. That's one of the first things that band, you know, both from, you know, the US or Europe, fail to understand, that, you know, if you do an East Coast tour, it's only 3 shows, Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne, and there's 1,000 kilometers between each one of those. You have to fly. There's no getting on a tour bus and, you know, schlepping it to the next city, because there is nothing in between. There is little towns, but there's nothing that you can actually substantially play at. So that, and each one of those cities, like on the East Coast, Brisbane, you know, North, Sydney in the middle, Melbourne in the South, and then you've got Adelaide over in the middle, and then Perth, which is closer to frigging South Africa than it is to Sydney.
Not really. Is it really?
I don't know. It's actually closer to Bali, I think, or Singapore, or something in Asia, Southeast Asia. It's actually closer to that than it is to Sydney. And so, yeah, it's the same distance from LA to New York, but there's nothing in the middle. So, you know, a lot of Perth people very unhappy when tours are announced by overseas artists and they're not on the list. Most of the time, Adelaide's not either. But, you know, it's a financial thing and a logistics thing and all of this kind of stuff. But also each one of those markets is very different. Melbourne is the home of hard rock. Sydney's kind of got this, you know, core thing about it. And, you know, Brisbane as well, but Brisbane's a bit more punk and hardcore as well. That's been very, very general, obviously, because, you know, a metal band can tour all five capital cities and have a great time in each of them. But locally, those scenes have their own distinct flavors.
Their own flavors, yeah.
But yeah, that kind of is the thing. It's not like all you Aussies. It's like, well, that's like saying all you Yanks. It's like, no. Well, first of all, not all of us are Yanks. But, you know, it's like, it's a big place with very different people in it. So this kind of catch-all mentality is not right, you know, which sure. is not wrong either, but it's just kind of like getting to know your audience a little bit.
Yeah, which is part of the game.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't even know, you know, how you would even break that down from the outside looking in, to be honest. It's, yeah, I don't know. You just have to come over here and find out when you're allowed.
Yeah, I mean, you know, well, and I think, okay, so one of the things I want to talk, it's kind of, so here's like an Australian thing that you understand that our readers won't understand or our listeners won't understand. I have been to Australia one time and I have spent more time in Perth than Chris.
Right.
Right. Cause I spent like 5 days in Perth and you've spent like an afternoon there or something. Right.
Yeah. It wasn't even 24 hours. Yeah. Cause why do I need to go there?
Yeah, exactly.
And like,
right?
And like I said, it's not like people crisscrossing the nation. Your LA to New York in American terms, and as far as people movement, is our Sydney to Melbourne. Yeah. Sydney to Melbourne, it was actually the busiest air route in the entire world.
That doesn't surprise me.
It's like 800 and something, nearly 900 kilometers on the road driving, which, yeah, you can do in a day, a half a day. But yeah, an hour flight each way. So, you know, so many people would commute even, you know, I know, you know, especially when I worked at the labels, people would, you know, go down there and be back for dinner, you know, that kind of thing. So
yeah.
Perth, on the other hand, 5 hours that way, 3.5 coming back if you get the tailwind. But literally, yeah, a very, very small remote city with, you know, I think not even 2 million people in it. Unless you actually have business in there or you want to go and see the sunset in the Indian Ocean for a change, then
there's no reason. Which is pretty cool, I'll just say.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very, very far away.
Yeah, no, this is kind of the thing. So, okay, so then to circle back on this, okay, so when it comes to, so you get, you know, because you do quite a few big mainstream metal bands,
yes.
Right, via these labels, and I get the impression you get a lot of like independent clients who are pretty big too.
Yeah, it's literally everything. And you know, the last kind of 2 or 3 years, it's, you know, I did get pigeonholed into the metal thing for a while, which was fine because I'm a big metal fan, but it's kind of like the last couple of years the majors have been giving me other work that's not just heavy stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, a typical day was, you know, really weird where it might be an independent black metal band in the morning and Bonnie Tyler in the afternoon, you know, on the same day kind of thing. It's just,
yeah,
it all happens. So, yeah.
How does that, I didn't realize you did Bonnie Tyler. Like, how does that differ doing a contemporary or not? Well, no, doing a classic pop star campaign versus a metal campaign. How does the logic shift? How do you tackle things differently?
I that's the funny thing, because I started at major labels. I actually started in TV when I first finished university. I
remember you telling me that.
Yeah, I spent time, like at the majors, it was like metal was the odd one out and I had the long hair before I cut it off and grew it back, and they'd almost flippantly give it to me. You like this band, you can have it. And here's a $40,000 marketing budget, which was off the cuff in 2000. Now,
yeah, of course. You say like, that and I'm like...
Yeah, I did Cradle of Filth for Sony in Australia for that. I can't remember the name of the album. I think it came out in 2002. Yeah, $40,000 marketing budget that was an afterthought.
Yeah, for like the tiny market that, like.
Yeah. You can just have this chump change over here. And
the market wasn't as developed then as it is now, from what I understand. Well,
to be honest, I had a hard time allocating it, you know, because there wasn't, because this is the thing, these people are used to doing Jennifer Lopez or Anastasia at the time, or, you know, friggin' Mandy Moore or some massive pop star like that, Bruce Springsteen, yeah, Michael Jackson, you know, whatever. So that was literally three TV spots worth of money kind of thing. So, okay, fast forward to now. How does, so what I meant was I learned how to deal with all different kinds from the majors. When I moved to the independent that had all the metal labels on it, I kind of took the major label understanding and training and ran it through indie metal labels. It's like, and I would ring the press and it's like, what do you mean you don't know who Soilwork are? Of course you do. But yeah, no, we don't. And it's like, okay. So I'd kind of treat the band, and this was around 2005, 2006, I would treat the priorities from a label like Metal Blade or Nuclear Blast the same as I would if it was 50 Cent or Bruce Springsteen from a majors, from it's right. Like, okay, I have a job to do. And pretty much fast forward to now, it's just the same process, different media. You know, with Bonnie Tyler or any of those legacy acts, I've actually, and the advent, you know, the rise of Zoom in this pandemic has been really, really great for morning TV, because before, you know, Today Show or Sunrise or something like Good Morning America or whatever like that, if they're doing an overseas interview with someone, they'd have to line up a satellite. The artist would have to go down to their local network station and book a time.
It was a situation.
All this stuff, right? Now it's just like, here's a Zoom link, go for it. And that's made a hell of a difference. Like Alice Cooper just sits in his studio where he does his Nights with Alice Cooper thing. And he goes, who am I talking to today? 1, 2, 3, 4, knocks them all out. Heaps better. So with Bonnie Tyler, for example, she lives in Portugal now. So she's on GMT, you know, UK time. So it was very easy to just go 5 o'clock in the morning here, pre-record for the show ahead that morning, flick the switch, and away it goes. There was no coordinating of anybody. She didn't have to go anywhere, just have to get dressed kind of thing. So the difference is those major heritage artists or even the bigger artists that are new, it's just a switch in the target market as far as the media is concerned. You know, morning TV, major newspapers, major radio versus, you know, metal blogs and you know, college community radio shows for that will play that sort of stuff. So it's a kind of the same process, really.
Okay, just that's interesting.
That, you know, I've spent a career nurturing those relationships. So, you know, and the morning TV people are the ones that think it's funny. They're like, oh, what else you got on today? Oh, Behemoth. And like, what's that? It's like, okay. But the other way around, it's like, oh, I'm doing such and such on Channel 9. It's like the because obviously those mainstream media outlets are very limited, shall we say, in their knowledge of heavy things. They think it, you know, maybe AC/DC or Guns N' Roses or something like that. That's, and they're very old school. So, you know, I don't care. As long as they're keen and they're very interested to talk to people. Like I just did Gary Newman's album and they all loved it. You know, they're all very happy to see him. And he was very happy to have that much press as well.
Yeah. And so now talk about the consulting wing of things. So you, because you mentioned earlier, you started it up and it's going good.
Yeah. Well, I kind of, before I started it, it was a bouncing around in my head about how, because bands were always ringing me that were very either green or kicking around for a while and not getting anywhere. And it's like, sure, can you help me with, can we employ you for a PR campaign? Because, you know, you were either recommended somewhere or we saw you do your work with this. I actually had one band go, we saw you work with Alice in Chains. It'd be great to help us. And I'm like, yeah, well, you're not Alice in Chains.
Yeah, so, which is like, I always feel like that's like this, and you don't do this, which I appreciate about you, and you understand this, but I feel like there's sort of a scam with a lot of big PRs who do like Alice in Chains, who then go pick up tiny unsigned bands and charge them like $5,000 and then don't do anything.
I don't like the exploitation. And this is honestly, like, I have like a spiel that I write. If somebody comes to me now and goes, you know, hey, we got a single out next week. First of all, that's mistake number one. If you're waiting a week before you drop your single to engage a PR person, then that's just on you. But second, I go, look, you know, I'm not here to, you know, I could easily take the PR job because it's actually more money than the consults. So, but it's not really fair for them, because ultimately what I found out was that I would do the PR campaigns and I was doing them and they would get the results in the press. But it didn't move the needle anywhere, because I was kind of saying, look, you know, I got you a piece, say in Blabbermouth, for example, but it's like, you know, if you're scrolling the feed there, you see Corey Taylor does this and Dave Mustaine says this and Band X is here and underneath that, D. Snyder says that. Unless you have any recognition of brand recognition of that band name in that article, you're scrolling on by. I don't care who you are.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. So I could turn around to the band and go, hey, look, I got you a piece in Blabbermouth. Look at this. How good is this? Here's a link. And they go, fantastic. But ultimately, no one saw it. And it was a waste of everybody's time and even a waste of the media's time, because I checked with everyone before I said, I'm gonna go charge bands money to say this about you and you and you. And I went to Spotify and I said, I'm going to say this. What do you think? And all that. So the media are kind of more appreciative because they're like, well, look, I don't want to spend 15, 20 minutes creating a news article that no one's going to read.
Yeah. Well, this is the, yeah. And this is the problem is I feel like a lot of people don't talk about this, but like frequently the least read articles on a lot of these blogs are reviews and premieres.
Yes. Premieres, unless a band was really on my case to do one, I'd try not to, because first of all, it alienates all the other media that didn't get the premiere, so they're unlikely to cover it. Second, you see the results. No one gives a shit. And it's like, oh, we got our video. And it's like, unless you are a band, unless you are Tool, unless you are Slipknot, unless you were Maiden last week or the week before, look at that. It was like 6 million views off the bat. Unless you're that, who cares about your premiere? Go and stick it up on your YouTube channel and market for a premiere on your own thing. Fortnite down the line, 2 weeks for you Americans, and promote the hell out of that and go, everybody go to our channel. And you've got 2 weeks to get as many people to that and try and trigger your own algorithm versus somebody else's. So the kind of whole like reason for it was, yeah, it wasn't working for them as much as I'd like, or the radio play wasn't transitioning into Spotify plays or any of this sort of stuff. So I'm like, what's going on? Right. The vast majority of bands that would come to me all had the same thing. A couple of thousand people on their Facebook or something like that, or none, but then absolutely shit numbers on their Spotify and their YouTube channels, which are the two channels that really need the most yeah. numbers and the most interaction and the most engagement to actually get somewhere. Somebody told me that runs this service said that, you know, like 85% of all new music is discovered through algorithmic searches, which means basically yeah. you're told what to listen to by the machine based on what you've listened to previously. So I was pulling all that together. It's like, right, no one looks at the press, no one looks at this, no one looks at that, unless you have some kind of brand awareness. All right, well, let's strip it back. How do we start with that? And if a band has, you know, 2,000, because let's face it, if you've got four or five people in the band, it's pretty easy to get up to 2,000 likes on your band page on your Facebook pretty easily just by requesting all your friends go and do it. Right? Doesn't mean anything though, because then you look at it and you'll say, okay, you've got 2,000 people on your Facebook, you've got 57 people on your Spotify. That's nothing. Might as well be nothing. So yeah. if you have 2,000 people on your Facebook, you've got a potential ready-made audience there. Let's work on building your brand and an emotional attachment to that brand to get the remaining 1,943 people that aren't on your Spotify over to it.
Over there, yeah.
Rather than trying to build an audience from people that that don't know you yet, you've already got them. If you could get your Spotify numbers to match your Facebook numbers, then a hell of a lot of things are going to start happening for you. And that's the goal. It's kind of like, okay, so how do we do that? That's the other question. So, well, it's content, it's strategy, it's branding, but a lot of the things. So I created this like 40-page PDF, which was a bit like an Anthony Robbins kind of course. It's like each section kind of then reflects back. It's like, okay, what is it, our brand? Like, yeah, Iron Maiden, McDonald's, Disney, Coca-Cola, they are all brands that are bigger than they are. You know, everyone knows what Coca-Cola is. Not everyone's had Coca-Cola, but the brand supersedes them as far as volume goes. And it also has an emotional trigger response. When I say Iron Maiden to you or Slipknot or Coke or McDonald's, good, bad, or indifferent, you have an emotional response. If I say Band X, who's that? Right. But if you could actually start working before you even go to press, just a little bit on fans and getting your fans excited about your product, because let's face it, that's what it is. Getting that initial groundswell so that then that has a kind of catches fire. That's more important and that's more genuine and more leads into potential growth than being nowhere and having a PR campaign trying to do all the heavy lifting for you, because no one has that attention span anymore. When I was 15 years old, I had one metal magazine in Australia and one national metal show on Tuesday nights, which is still going. It's had five different name changes, but that was it. It was my whole world. whatever was in the mag and whatever was on a radio station, I devoured. Fast forward 30 years, music is just like such the smallest part of your entertainment pie. You've got Netflix and PlayStations and Xboxes and Instagrams and all this other stuff. So if music is only a very small portion of that, there's even a smaller portion still that's available for people to find new music. So what is it about you that is going to be in that slither of a percent? And it better be good, because they're not going to just give you their attention just because you asked for it. So there's this whole process about building that and doing that so that you become, at least in there, like curious to people that are searching for sort of stuff that you're providing. You know, you're meeting a need. That's what you're doing.
Absolutely. I think you're right. And I think this is the thing, is I think I always think people need to consider how they consume and realize that's probably how other people consume.
I actually go through that in the thing. One of the very first things I say to them is like, yeah, you know, our album's coming out and it's got 10 songs and it's coming out in 6 weeks. It's like, when was the last time you listened to 10 songs from a new album that was on Spotify that wasn't one of your favorite
bands you like?
Yeah. And you can see the results, because if you showed me any album on Spotify, I'll tell you which ones are the singles, because they've got way more numbers than the rest of them. So if you treated everything with the same kind of purpose, all those numbers might be evened up. Yeah. And if you go do the traditional album release, two singles, drop album, forget about it, you're doing the rest of those songs a massive disservice, because they're out, they have no attention, they kind of just drift away.
So that's like for the pitching to like algorithmic playlists and stuff, right? It's like you could either do, you know, six singles and pitch seven times because you have a focus track on a release day, or you can do two singles and pitch three times because there's a focus track on a release day.
You know, I've actually said, it's like, where does it say in the musician's playbook that you must release an album anyway? I'm a big fan of, like, if maybe it's not feasible for a band to do this, but if you've got your album in the can and you've got 10 songs, well, why aren't you releasing one song every week for 6 weeks over 12 months, so you're in everyone's face for a year, rather than two singles, drop album, you're done in 8 weeks, and then you've got nothing to give them until the next cycle, which could be 2 years away. You know, if you always, like, you know, massive Metallica fan, I would much rather they drop a song every 3 or 4 months than an album every 6 years, let's face it, you know?
Yeah, although I think at that level, it's sort of a different...
Well, yeah.
But I loved that. Honestly, there was this great Metal Sucks headline the other day about all the Black Album stuff they're doing, and the headline was like, the Metallica beatings will continue until morale improves. Because it's just like, here's some more. You like the Black Album? Choke on the Black Album. Well, but you kind of have to admire that.
Well, it's actually interesting that you raise that, because that Black Album came out and when I was in year 9 at school, 15, I was the perfect age to be corrupted by that record. And when you look at how it was done, there were 6 singles from that record.
Yeah.
And I think, Sandman was first. I can't remember what the second single was, but vast majority of them were released post-album. So they basically flogged that for another year and then went on the road for 3 years after the fact. So, you know, and this is the thing. It's like, you know, these days, it's like if you drop something and it's you're the flavor of the week, next week someone else is. So how can you think someone's going to stick around, and have any kind of loyalty to you if you're not there? If you're not there, it's somebody else next week. You know, like new release Friday comes around and whatever, you know, how often do the bands stay in the chart more than 3 weeks, 2 weeks? They're gone. You know, so everyone just devours and moves on. So it's like, if you had, like I said, you know, maybe not Metallica, but, you know, pop and hip hop artists are really good at that. They're single driven and it's consistent. So, and it almost goes back to how music was done in the first place in the 50s and 60s. No one had an album out till like the mid 60s. It was single. So
yeah. It was like, people who figured it out were the Beatles.
Yeah.
But that was a different game. And
yeah, well, people know, didn't get it. And that's fine, but it's like, you know, now that you can consume, everything's at your fingertips and everyone wants everything now, it's like, well, yeah, I mean, you know, people are refreshing their feed so much that what happened this morning is irrelevant to what's happening to them in their evening. So how can an album that came out a month ago have any bearing on them? And that's like ancient and it's horrible. I'm not sort of saying that, you know, and a band, you know, I've had people go, well, I shouldn't have to release my stuff to fit other people's lifestyles. And I understand that, but at the same time, it's the hand we've been dealt currently. This is the way music is consumed.
Well, I think I think it's important to be, in my eyes, I think it's important to just be like, cool, I'm a hobby band, tight. You know what I mean? Like, I want to do it this way. Okay. You know, and I think that there's like this weird like thing against hobby bands, but the people I know who are in like serious hobby bands tend to be the people who are happiest.
I think they understand the reality of.
Yeah, well, because they're like, okay, they're at, like, you know, like, I like being a lawyer, and, you know, but I also like having a cool rock band who can play to 100 people twice, you know, six times a year.
But those bands that get pissed off when it's not happening for them and they blame everybody else very rarely kind of sit there. It's exactly like a business. It's like when what I say in those consults is like, park the emotional attachment at the door. Because this is a business meeting. And I understand it. I'm a drummer myself. I know that people don't like to objectively look at their music. But for this exercise, you have to. Because it's like...
it's hard.
Is called the music industry, not the music, like, let's give you a frigging handout. And I understand. It's like, yeah, but the biggest thing, especially when, you know, you mentioned pitching before, one hot tip is not, you know, when you're pitching for Spotify, no one at Spotify gives a shit that this is the sickest riff ever, that it's got the heaviest breakdown and you've got, you know, the fastest double kick in the universe. They don't care. They'll listen to that. What they want to hear is that you are this band from this place. You are doing these tour dates. You have three singles and an album and some marketing coming up, and we'd like to be considered for playlists X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
Business plan. That's a fucking great pitch. Way better than being emotional. It's like if a Spotify editor was looking at those two different pitches, they go, well, band A, who's literally outlined everything that they've got going on in their world, knows what they're doing. Band X over here, sick riffs, mate. It's like, yeah, you might, but what do you want us to do with these? You know, that's the kind of, and once people get an understanding, that's all it is. It's just like an understanding of how the system works. Once you do that, the sort of shutters come off and you kind of go, ah, okay. No one's asking you to compromise your music or do anything like that. It's just like there is a better way to reach people than what you're doing now.
And that's, you know, just...
And traditional PR.
As we head towards the end, I just want to point that out on the no one's asking you to compromise your music thing. That's something I really have noticed working with like major label people and stuff. Is and even big independents is like sometimes the label doesn't like what I see more often than not is sometimes the label doesn't necessarily agree with the artist's vision, but if the artist is and can say like, hey man, maybe try this, but if the artist puts their foot down, the label will still fight like hell to support that vision.
Absolutely. I mean, this is why they
and I think that people seem to think the label will just be like, oh, I disagree, fuck you, and I've never really seen that be the case.
This whole belief, I think they've watched too many documentaries of like, oh, they want us to turn into Bon Jovi sellouts. It's like, well, if you had that ability, I would say do that.
Yeah, right? Like that's the thing. Sometimes you're just like, bro, like, you're really good at this. Let's just do that. And like...
Well, you know, there is a... I'll tell you when we hang up. I'm not going to name and shame anybody, but there was a particular band in the... on the cusp of the new metal era that was kind of guided into their superstardom, which happened for them, but they were all metal fans and they were like, I would rather be, you know, kind of slayery, you know, in my approach. And it's like, yeah, maybe dial it back, add some more melody, get, you know, a woman out front and your life will change. And it did. You know, at sort of obviously certain creative costs, but I don't think they give a shit from their yacht, do they? But what most bands think is like, we'll sign to a label and they'll tell us to sound more like this. And it's like, well, to be unlikely, but also to be fair, if you are a generic thrash band, why do you want to be a generic thrash band if you have the ability to tweak it and just make things a little bit more interesting so they stand out?
Well, and that's because something
there's 10 thrash bands coming out next week. You know what I mean?
That's something I admire about like Ryan at Metal Blade does a really good job of like, not telling people what to do, but being like, hey, how about we put you in with this producer? You know, and he's really good at like identifying the right producer or the right mixing engineer to take a product that is an 88% and making it a 96%, right? Where it's
just like getting a mentor at any other discipline. Yeah, really.
And he's great. And I think that's super valuable because it's like, oh, cool. Like, we have this cool thing that like your friend mixed. Let's get this guy. And now we've you know, it's just taking it to that next step.
It's exactly like, you know, sometimes when you hear, speaking of the Black Album, you're going to hear all the demo versions and all of those kind of things. And it's just like hearing a remix and you kind of go, you know, if you hear something and then you hear like a demo on how it was before, it's like, what would it have been like if the, you know, chorus was done at half the speed or these lyrics, it wouldn't be what you know now. So it's just, sometimes it takes that to create that magic, you know what I mean? It's like you hear alternate versions of songs and you're like, wow, what sort of different world would it be if that was actually the big hit? And it's like, it's, you know, director's cut kind of thing. But I'm not, you know, it's more bands need to be a little bit more willing to have people just offer that creative criticism. And that's all it is. It's like, if you're that gung-ho about your creative vision is yours and no one can mess with it, well then what do you want a label for anyway? Just go and do your thing, you know? Yeah. And there's a whole other conversation, which we don't have time for today, which is label versus independent, especially today, in today's climate.
But to head towards the end,
you have
how can people get in touch with you if they want to work with you?
Well, best thing is probably on the website, which is Marik Media, spelled M-A-R-I-C, media.com. I did get rid of the AU for International Man of Mystery. So it's just marikmedia.com. One of the things I don't like is when people friend me on Facebook, which I, you know, I'm quite happy to have you as a friend, but don't message me there and keep doing that if I don't respond. Like, it's like message is not really professional in the first instance, you know.
Well,
if you're dropping an intro to me, do it through the front door, because otherwise it's like, hey bro, you know, heard you were great, can you do this? It's like, man, I'm talking to my mum right now on Facebook. I don't need that at 11 o'clock at night. Send me an email. I live on my email. The emails get read, and I would rather it be there than lost in 300 people that are messaging me. It's not a critique. It's just like, man, it's what you're more likely to get me to answer you on email. That's for sure.
Absolutely.
Just chris@marikmedia.com as well, which is on the
perfect website. There you go. This has been Matt Meets the Music Industry. You have been listening. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you very much.
This is Chris DeMakes, guitarist and vocalist for Less Than Jake and host of Chris DeMakes, a podcast. A songwriting podcast where every week I'm joined by an amazing guest to break down the writing, recording, and release of one iconic song from their career. In our giant evergreen back catalog of episodes, we've had rock legends such as Dee Snider and Huey Lewis, punk rock favorites like Mark Hoppus, Fat Mike, and Brett Gurewitz, and up-and-coming artists of today such as Liz Stokes of the Beths and Genesis Owusu. We've had guests from all genres and styles of music, and I guarantee that if you peruse our back catalog, you'll see several episodes that'll make you say, man, I gotta hear that. Whether you're a fan of music or a creator of music yourself, you'll take away a whole new appreciation for the songs you know and love. Chris DeMakes, a podcast is available for free on all the places you could possibly listen to podcasts, and new episodes come out every Monday.